Start to get started.
And Randy, maybe just to say a few words that make sure people are okay that they're being filmed.
Sir, okay.
That they're being filmed.
Ah, okay. Uh huh. Is this broadband through a camera?
I mean, I don't know what the policy is. Normally, if it's IDRC filming you, we need all your consent.
Ah, okay.
So
anybody object to being filmed? So it's, yes, that's right. Okay, I think we'll get started. I am not Amartya Sen. Amartya said he might be a little bit late, but he'll take over when he comes. I wanted to start the session by asking Chris Coward if he'd say a... Chris here?
Yes, sir.
Okay, sorry. If he'd say just a few words. I think there's a plan to do a special edition of ITID, and Chris has something to say about that. Thanks, Chris.
One of the ideas that we had with Berkman Center and IDRC and Mike Best and I coming into this was an opportunity to have this discussion get out into an academic journal as well. And so we've been discussing the idea of having these essays appear in a special issue of a journal that's very prominent in our field, Information Technologies and International Development. Mike is the co-editor along with Francois Barr at the University of Southern California. It's an open access journal. It's in its sixth year, I believe, something of that sort. And the idea would be to send out an invitation to everyone that submitted essays for this and take an opportunity to refine, reflect, maybe taking in some of the conversations that have transpired over these 2 days to sharpen your arguments, and then we'd collect that for this special issue. So I think this would be a terrific opportunity to extend the conversation through a journal format. So I think the process will be we'll be sending out an invitation very shortly, within the next week or two, kind of codifying the kind of our instructions and request for the special issue, and we would invite all of you to submit a revised piece for this journal. So I'm not sure if people have any questions, and Mike can also speak more about the journal itself if there are other questions. Deadlines. I think we'd like to do this within 2 to 3 months. Get this done, and we'll put. We will put it into.
Get the first submissions into.
Get yeah.
Because the process itself then would be another few months of revision and then copy editing, typesetting. So it does take a little.
Yes.
Is there a limit on the pages? I mean.
The entire volume would have to be roughly 50,000 words or less, so that's the limit. But obviously, that would mean that some pieces could easily extend to 10 pages or 15 pages, and they'd still be under our order.
Could I have just one thing? One other thing to add is that so many of the pieces that you prepared would be basically, I think, ready to go in now. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it would be up to you if you wanted to revise them further. But one of the things that we thought might be interesting in particular is if people in this room were struck by the ideas of others and actually wanted to collaborate, either on joining pieces or coming up with a new piece altogether. So the idea that each of us has brought our perspectives and experiences and work into this room to share with the others is wonderful, but then also to think, what emerges from that, and do we develop new ideas and new areas for research, exploration, action? And I think, I mean, as stated, this is the idea for it, but there is certainly some flexibility within it, and mm-hmm. we would encourage you to approach either Mike or Chris especially, although I'm also happy to help if you have questions or suggestions or things that we could work with you on to make this more appealing. Because obviously, I mean, ideally, this is just a great opportunity to get your work out there, to get it into the academic community so that it doesn't just stick, for the most part, in this room or with the audiences that we reached last night, but really mm-hmm. it has staying power.
Okay. Thanks, Colin. Thanks.
Chris. Anybody that doesn't think this is a good idea, who does not want to do this?
I think it's a go.
All right.
You know, unless you get written objections later on. Okay. How long can they be? How long? The objections? Sorry. Too early in the morning. Let's start in then. This session is about knowledge gaps. We had originally called it research priorities. We said a lot yesterday about research priorities, and I think one of the things the organizers were probably due, and I maybe should have spent a little time last night on, is pulling together what we said already about research priorities. But I think it's a good idea to have a session that focuses a little more specifically on that. Gives us a chance to, say some new things, reformulate a little bit of what people said yesterday, and pull those ideas together. And we have, I believe, four people. Sabri has left, I believe. We have the other four on the program. We'll start with kind of up to 10 minutes, and I guess I would start with Clotilde, if that's okay with you.
Good morning, everyone. Yes, I think that in my paper I had specifically focused on research priorities because that was one of the indications. But I think that looking at what the discussions have been these days, I think that one of the areas that are certainly very important is to look at indicators of impact. I think that there's a great lack there, and there is a very serious problem of communication between people on the field doing the work and especially funding agencies and international development aid agencies, particularly in the case of development banks. I hear many, many colleagues in the field with difficulties trying to express the impacts and the developments that they have accomplished in terms that are acceptable or understandable by development banks. In general, the impact collection tools or resources that development banks expect are analog in nature, to say it in some way. And even researchers in the field are having difficulty in showing in the terms that these institutions would expect the obvious, very powerful results that they are identifying. Very frequently, these results are described as anecdotal or not scalable, or, you know, there's a whole topic of terminology, and there's great difficulty in dialogue. Very recently, last week, there was a discussion at the Inter-American Development Bank the use of one-on-one, you know, mobile computers in the world of education, and this was one of the discussions. And people in the field feel very frustrated that they cannot communicate in the terms that these banks would understand the impacts, especially because very frequently they want to connect this to results in academic standardized tests and changes in quote-unquote learning, which are very traditional, and there's not a more open approach in the area of, for example, of ecologies of learning, which is, I think, another topic to be explored. I wanted to mention that in this respect, IDRC had financed a very interesting project to the Omar Dingo Foundation about 5 years back to look at, to develop a methodology to establish impact of technology projects oriented to create conditions of equity. And there's a whole methodology that was developed there to look at these issues that is useful both for addressing to look for impact, to identify where you can find this impact, but at the same time, it's a methodology that is very useful for a project design because it allows you to take a look at that, and much of the grounding for this work comes from Amartya Sen's ideas in terms of equity and freedom. So it might be something interesting to look into. The publication, which is a book, it was published initially in Spanish, but there's a summary in English at the IDRC website and our ODF. The other topic associated to that would be the development of standards, because when you're trying to scale up projects or to deal with massive efforts, especially in the area of education, as has been our case, the difficulty is that no matter how much teacher development you conduct, I'm not talking just about teacher training or facilitator training, I'm talking about a more holistic approach to teacher development, it is very difficult to get results that are, obviously would not be homogeneous, but according to a certain basic standard, especially when you're dealing with efforts to address thinking skills, problem solving, creativity, issues of this nature, which are certainly much more difficult to pinpoint than when you're dealing with computer skills in a traditional sense. So I think that a lot of work needs to go into that. We have initiated this work at ODF, and we have just come up with this publication on learning standards and focused on project-based learning and learning by doing approaches. And it establishes standards for looking at creativity, thinking, collaboration, ethics, and proactivity. And these are very difficult topics to deal with, especially since the education community is still a little bit traditional in approach. But these have been efforts that we have conducted, and I think that a lot more has to go in this direction. If you really want to have national impact or regional impact beyond a pilot project or beyond a very specific school-based approach. So that is another of the elements. I think that very much in line with the discussions that we had yesterday, particularly some of the issues that both Anita and Lawrence brought up, I think that it is important to be able to address these issues seriously and to provide people who are trying to do innovation with technology with better tools to show what is happening and to think about the ways in which they can address these topics. Then another area of research that initially had some support, I'm not sure what happened in the way, or perhaps if my perspective is not well informed, but there was a lot of interest 4 or 5 years ago on learning communities online. And some of that has gone to a peer-to-peer teacher learning communities, but in general, in the wider spectrum of development, it is not easy to find funding for these initiatives. And I wonder why, because this is a major area of development. Everything, you know, if you go to the Harvard COOP or if you go to the MIT COOP and look at books or at the MIT Press, there are lots of things on collaboration, on networking, and there's a lot of academic interest in these topics on sociability, how we can use networks to connect, but I have not found so many resources available to do research on networking, on communities through networks. And a year and a half ago, we conducted at ODF a Latin American workshop on learning networks and networks to learn. And we were sort of stopped in the middle because it was this energy, a lot of reflection, a lot of interest in the region, but the funding was not there from funders that in the past had supported this type of initiative. So I think that it is something to look into that might be of interest to all of us. Then the other area that I suggested in my paper and that I think it is very important, it is to be able to strengthen the leadership in key understandings and conceptual views about what technology can do for development. My experience has been that many leaders and politicians in the developing world have very limited, very restricted views about what these technologies are. There is a lot of magical thinking. I think this is no news for most of you. But there is also the idea that there's sort of a bulletproof equation, which is infrastructure plus content. And I think most of us know what people think about infrastructure. I'm not sure we all know what people mean by content. And this issue of content really has to be unpacked. And very frequently, the key part of this equation, which is the person, the learner, the activator, the whoever is interacting there, I'm not only talking about school environments, or I'm talking socially, is absent. So this infrastructure and this content is frequently developed thinking that this is going to have to generate impact, but without taking into consideration the learning profiles, the interaction profiles of these individuals and groups that are going to be involved. And this is an issue that was somewhat addressed during WISIS, but if you take a look at the post-WISIS efforts, it is still extremely poor. I attended a meeting conducted by a UN actor to take a look at what was happening in the after WISIS process in Latin America. And the projects are really extremely limited in view, very focused, very technocentric, very focused on the deployment of the technology. And some of the literature that some of these UN agencies are preparing goes precisely in changing this. But this is sort of the momentum that is moving among these leaders, moving in this very limited sphere. And I think that those of us who make an effort, I don't know if successful or not, but at least a modest effort to understand the issues associated to the knowledge economy and to the knowledge society and its relationship to development, find that that many of these understandings people see as academic when they are really the reflection of what is happening in the world, what is taking place in more advanced societies that are more concerned with ubiquity, with having digital technologies across the board transforming everything, while we are just trying to focus on the technology per se. And then the other topic that I would like to stress is the importance of developing the competencies, the skills, the education elements that allow new generations to learn what are now referred to as 21st century skills. There is a great effort in the developing world to address these, and there is very little going on in the analysis of how these skills could be addressed or translated to development contexts in very practical terms. We know that as we all have perceived and as Amartya stressed during the 2003 Harvard Forum, that the information society or the knowledge society is a skills-intensive society. And unless children learn at a very early age, and I insist in this because this has to do with educational systems and new approaches to learning, unless we provide these kids in the developing world with opportunities, not only to interact with technology, but also to interact with these new competencies, to appropriate these new competencies and skills, the gap is going to become bigger and bigger. This is a cognitive issue. This is an issue about how the mind functions, how the mind is stimulated to learn, and how the mind is allowed to interact with these human potential enhancing technologies. I think that this is not just a communication technology. This is these are technologies that can really enhance human potential. But that doesn't happen for free or immediately. This has to be led. This has to be mediated. And there is very little work in this area. If you come to a place like Cambridge, you know, there are pockets where you can go, obviously, here at Harvard Project Zero, the Berkman Center. You go to MIT, and there's the Media Lab and several other. But this has to go out to children in general. And I think that investing in the young, investing in children, is very cost-effective. We have seen this in Costa Rica. We started in 1988. Everybody thought we were absolutely crazed. And this was a very risky political decision that President Oscar Arias was willing to take. But we were very conscious that going in this direction meant lots of investment over long periods of time and that it was risky. And not all leaders are willing to risk in that way. So I think that providing tools that can allow for this to happen and to happen quite massively through the support of education systems and community projects with a very open learning approach, because you learn in school, you learn at the community, you learn in work, you learn everywhere. You know, learning is a continuum. It happens only within the bounds of the classroom. I think that trying to make an effort there can really make a contribution in preparing young minds, not only for interactions with technology, but for meaningful transformative interactions. I would stop there and perhaps come up with other things later.
Okay. Thank you very much. And with your permission, Professor Zanov, I'm going to turn this over to you.
No. You continue to chair, please. I'm going to step in.
Okay.
There are three more conferences in these this week. I'm teaching course during. There's only so little, how much I can keep in my head.
Okay. So okay, fair enough. Well, thank you for...
I would really enjoy if I could listen rather than have to do it.
Okay, not a problem. Thanks. Then I can put on my CV that I stood in for emergency. Okay, I think we have Laurent next on the agenda. Oh.
Maybe I need to wait for the setup from Ono. It's okay. The pose is in. I'll focus mostly on three points. The first one is actually to think about the goal of what we're doing. If the assumption is that what we want to do is help facilitate and build knowledge societies, that is an assumption that I'm making, and maybe we can discuss that. I think the workshop also points to the fact that it's not enough to think about how we develop and facilitate knowledge societies. We also want inclusive and equitable knowledge societies. So then the key question for us is, how do we get there? The hypothesis that Matthew and I have posed is does openness or do open principles actually help you to achieve that goal of inclusive and equitable knowledge societies? And why was this an issue for us? Well, essentially because we knew that there's a clear linkage between ICTs and growth, especially at the macro level. Waverman has demonstrated this, but there's more and more questioning of whether you're actually getting the level of equality that you would hope for and inclusiveness that you would hope for through ICT investments. Some people like Charles Kenny have looked at the fact that Gini coefficients have actually increased when there were mobile investments. So our issue became, well, how do we ensure that you get more inclusiveness? And our hypothesis, as I said, is maybe through open principles. Maybe it is a way to ensure that you have more participation, more collaboration in information societies, and get the kind of benefits, social benefits, that you would hope for. So then the questions become, for us, very pragmatic things, like, do open educational resources actually lead to better learning outcomes? Do projects like having open government data actually lead to more democratic principles or more better government, you could say? Also, do open content licenses and open innovation actually lead to more and better innovation? These are the things that, especially in a developing country context, we don't really know right now, as far as I know. Maybe you have some things that you could point to that would be very useful. But as far as we know, we've had a hard time making that linkage between those open and networked activities and the actual development outcomes that we're looking for. So that's the first area that I would discuss in terms of knowledge gaps. The second one is something that I actually thought about during the day yesterday, and that's something that for now I've called From Interventions to Incentives. There's, many of you know, IDRC was very involved in actual ICT interventions and telesenders and things like that. There is still a debate going on as to whether that was a success or not. But more and more it seems clear that what we should be looking at is possibly incentives, creating the right incentives for markets to work, for technologies to be created, for all those things that help us achieve, again, those knowledge societies. So again, I put that out to you. Is that an appropriate take on this last 6 years? Can we say that we've learned that we should go more from intervention-based activities to incentive-creating activities? And the third point I would bring up is something that I actually read in The Economist recently that I thought was very interesting. It was about an interview of Dr. Grove, who, of course, is one of the more famous people who is with the chairman of Intel, big in semiconductors. And he talks about something called knowledge turns. And a knowledge turn, according to him, is basically that cycle of going from the hypothesis testing results to a new hypothesis. And that knowledge turn in the semiconductor industry takes about 18 months. So they're able to innovate just incredibly fast. The problem in the other sectors, so he cites the health industry, is that it takes 8 to 10 years for a knowledge turn to happen. So the question that I would put out again is, what can the other fields of development, whether it be health, education, all those fields, and innovation and economic innovation in general, what can they learn from the ICT industry, which has been, in general, quite good at innovating very quickly, at being able to get results back into the cycle very quickly? And to a certain extent, is that something that we're looking for and we want, and how do we spur that? So that's about it for me. Thanks.
Thanks, Laurel. Interesting. Okay, I think if we will stay in the order, if that's okay with you, Mike.
Sure.
Great. Thanks.
Good morning. I'd like to discuss understanding our knowledge gaps. My mother's calling. Oh, I spoke to her all last night. It's all taken care of. Or do we have an ICT for D field, or do we even want an ICT for D field? So recent discussions, either at already concluded ICT for D conferences and workshops, or here at the Harvard Forum, or in the planning discussions for future conferences, have reminded me of the sometimes strong and often unhelpful disciplinary walls that can be constructed across ICT for D's cross-disciplinary areas, and the common tendencies for this field to intellectually jog in place. Here's a bit of that story. Some of us were at a recent ICTD 2009 conference in Doha, Mike, Inika, a few, Chris. This is certainly one of the biggest and most robust peer review academic conferences in the ICT for space, for better or worse. And in full disclosure, I sit on its advisory board. So I've been following with keen interest a proposal to co-locate next year's ICT meeting to be held at Royal Holloway in London, to co-locate there a more technical, really a more computer science-focused conference. A bit more background on that. In August of this year, Tapan Parekh, who some of you may know is a faculty member at UC Berkeley, co-organized a workshop on computer science and global development in Berkeley, California. The workshop was supported by NSF funds and tasked with providing strategic vision to and mobilization of the computing research community around ICT4D themes. I'd summarize the questions of the workshop thusly. Is ICT4D work real computer science? How can we raise the profile of this work within traditional CS departments? How can we get more respect for the work? Do we need more formal structure and organization to accomplish any of these goals? To that last question, we responded with a yes. And a structure was mooted, namely an ACM Special Interest Group, or SIG, to cover the ICT for D intellectual space. ACM is the Association for Computing Machinery. It's the world's oldest computing professional society. Many of you will be knowing it. Work is currently underway to secure an ACM sanction for the SIG. Granted, I am always hesitant to grow new organizations or activities in our space, given what I see as an existing oversaturation that would seem to call for consolidation rather than proliferation. However, that notwithstanding, an ACM SIG and ICT4D seems like a perfectly fine idea to me. And along with this ACM SIG, though, has come a call for a technical only, really a computer science only conference in ICT4D, and the proposal is to co-locate this during the ICTD 2010 meeting in London. All three of these activities, ICTD 2009 in Doha, the NSF-supported workshop in Berkeley, and the proposal for an ACM SIG co-located conference at ICT 2010 in London, England, served to remind me how fractured our intellectual community can be between the social sciences and engineering, policymakers and the legal community, practitioners and researchers, and in my opinion, how perilous this split has become. So here's some of the things to reiterate, perhaps, that I've heard at these meetings. In Doha, the computer scientists felt that the conference overly privileged the social scientists' work. And for their part, the social scientists complained that the technical work lacked sophistication, was weak in evaluation, was not grounded in the needs and realities of the users. A common story that I would hear from the social scientists is the computer scientists would get up and say, "I decided to build this thing. So I worked on this thing, and then I worked a bit more on the thing, And then I adjusted the thing, and then the thing was done. Then I took my thing to Ghana, and I asked 10 people whether they liked my thing. 9 people liked my thing. Hurrah for my thing. In the Berkeley workshop, which was made up almost entirely of computer scientists, and I should add that for those who do not know me well, I am trained as a computer scientist, some people dismissed work that did not include technical innovations, including some of my own work, as lacking substance. So in this computer science formulation, work that rigorously observes and clarifies categories and purposes of ICT use in the global south is not appropriate or interesting for ICT4D conferences. Social scientists, meanwhile, express some skepticism that fundamental technical innovations are even required for ICT4D work, and often demonstrated a lack of interest in core technical issues. And as the discussion around this potential co-located ACM SIG event at ICTD 2010 continues, the potential to enhance unhealthy disciplinary walls has been closely examined. For example, could this ACM SIG siphon off all the techies to their own workshop, creating two entirely disconnected epistemic communities, further exacerbating the problems we already see? Thus, we sort of have an engineering versus social science straw man, both of whom I submit are laboring under dangerous misapprehensions. For computer scientists to think that work entirely focused on the social sciences is neither helpful nor needed for this ICT4D research is dangerously wrong. But for social scientists to maintain that fundamental technical innovation is relatively unnecessary or is techno-euphoric or is based on the erroneous assumption that the internet or the personal computer or mobile phone designs don't actually need any fundamental technical change and perhaps heterogeneous change that's different for the South versus the North, change that's truly could be empowering to the people, that too is wrong. For either group to think that they do not need to sit at the same conferences together, read each other's papers, understand the methods and underlying principles of each other's work, and even collaborate on co-authored papers, that is equally worrisome. Add to this the access to knowledge straw man. Of course, I'm constructing these straw men in order to tear them down, or perhaps I should say straw person, meaning I am not sure anybody subscribes to these views in whole. But the A2K gloss for me goes something like this. Knowledge is some reified static thing. It's sitting over there. Our job is to be sure that people have access to that knowledge over there. It is this straw man that offers but one of the many responses to the critique yesterday on my call for interactive personal communication. School, under this cartoon, is where young people go as empty vessels, passive and unthinking, and knowledge is poured into them. So back to the earlier previous two straw men. If a computer scientist does not value, or if that person's department does not understand that human observation and analysis and development is fundamental to all of our work, that's truly bad. If our social scientists do not value fundamental engineering innovation, or if they're unwilling to understand at a non-superficial level these technologies, that too is bad. Substitute lawyer or poverty economist or policy specialist into any of these positions, and the argument still generally obtains. And if any of these communities silos itself off from the other, that is the death knell to our interdisciplinary program. All of these challenges are answerable. The ACM SIG could be architected in a way to enhance, not extinguish, cross-disciplinary work. Traditional departments can grow and expand in ways that recognize they can't do it alone, and individuals can commit to studying and collaborating across the disciplines. And so here, finally, I come to, as a result of this disciplinary lumbering, the most significant and troubling, perhaps, knowledge gap. The biggest gap producing problematic in the ICT4D program as both an academic and field-focused project is that, in my estimation, it has failed profoundly to be a progressive intellectual enterprise. And by progressive, I mean it has failed to learn from the past. We have collectively failed to stand on the shoulders of those before us. And since the project, at least as we're really formulating it here during this Harvard Forum, is really only a decade old or so, I'm simply saying we have failed to stand upon each other's shoulders. Heeks reminds us that most all ICT4D projects end in failure, absolute failure, sustainability failure, partial failure. That is fine, and in my estimation, as far as that goes. The problem certainly is not the failures. The problem is our failure to learn from the failures, or indeed to failure to learn from those occasional successes as well. To conclude then, how can ICT4D become a progressive research endeavor? I believe there's at least four things we must do. One, return to our interdisciplinary and holistic roots and immerse ourselves in multiple literatures. Two, avoid those pitfalls of a fetishistic, techno-utopistic view that, regardless of our rhetoric, is far too common in reality. Three, spend time on fundamental innovation and work, and this means, in particular, find patient money. Four, develop a set of fundamental shared problems and shared methods and be sure that many of them are in the areas of evaluation and assessment. So to point one, the multi, inter, and transdisciplinary nature of our project, it's clear that we need to continue dialogues such as those started here at this second Harvard Forum. I, at least, need to do a better job of reading across the disciplines myself. But at the Berkeley conference, one of the most senior computer scientists in the ICT4D arena had this bright idea. We need to create an ICT4D journal. Well, there's at least a half dozen. We need to create an ICT4D trade magazine. There's more than a dozen. And we need to, you know, bring in people together at more conferences. There's hundreds of those. Clearly, he's just not reading the literature. While his blinkered condition is, in my estimation, reprehensible, last night, while leaving the public event, I was offered a CD with 101 IDRC books on ICT4D. I've probably read already, I mean, prior to getting the CD, 10, and maybe I've skimmed another 10 or something like that. I clearly need to hit the books. But this also goes to the problem of the academic and research communities in general. We are all rewarded for writing, but not rewarded for reading. So our incentives are to create more and more knowledge, and even in the presence of access to it, never connect back. Thus, my extremely pleasant surprise at the so-called two-pagers developed for this meeting, so-called because most of them were like 8 pages, I think. This was not a quintessential workshop producing a bunch of write-only documents, and that is what I had feared would be the outcome. You all read each other's work, and bravo to you for that and for having come with such a deep understanding of each other's papers. I, of course, regret deeply that I did not have a paper in the collection. To the third point that I made on fundamental work and patient money, I really must turn to the donors. With only a few exceptions, the period of performance on every award I have ever received in my academic career has been 18 months or under. To IDRC's credit, you have indeed funded long-term projects. Of course, I know of the 5-year public access to the Internet program as an example. But USAID has never given me any money that lasted longer than 12 months. And then has tormented me as I plead for no-cost extensions. And finally, to my fourth and last point. We all probably recall the story that at the start of the 20th century, the German mathematician David Hilbert proposed a set of foundational research questions designed to help focus the attention of mathematicians on the most important questions of their time. These Hilbert problems helped define much of the last century of mathematical research and led to a nice number of surprises and scandals. Of course, I think of Alonzo Church and Alan Turing and Kurt Gödel, shaking the very foundations of their field. The ICT4D community needs to develop a similarly weighty list of grand challenges that will focus our collective intention and help us track forward progress as it is made. I wonder whether the group here assembled might be ideally suited to channel the ghosts of Hilbert and formulate these grand challenges. This might make for great front matter to a special issue of ITID. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mike. Okay. Ono, are you set? Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me to this event. My perspective may be a little bit different because I'm not really a researcher. I'm more an activist and jobless. So it's very much informal ways to attack the knowledge gap problem. It's very much field experience, not much theory. Our major, my perspective, mostly from Indonesian side, it's more on the, what we are looking at is the number of people. Like we have 220 million people. We have, 240,000 schools. We have 46.5 million students. We have 2.5 million teachers. So we are looking at that kind of numbers. And I'm from informal sector. I'm not from formal sector. So I have no money. It's not really funded. We finally receiving some funding from the government, finally, last year, for writing books, but not for reading books. But I really agree to what Lauren said on the, what's it, in no, 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 incentive, okay. For example, IDRC actually responsible for the liberation of 2.4 gigahertz in Indonesia. That's an example. What IDRC did is basically grab me from the ground to the international level and creating image to the Indonesians that what bad thing we are doing is actually right thing. So that kind of thing is it's creating huge impact within the society to see that what we are doing is actually right. It's we actually fund our activity ourselves, but by escalating the bad guys to the international forum like this, that's really creating self-esteem. Yeah. Something like that to the community. And that's creating more a replication and adoption of the technology within the society. So that's one example, the liberation of 2.4 gigahertz. After the liberation, that's what happened is innovation is coming in because a lot of people wants to grab the, the wants to implement the technology, but it's too expensive if we buy it from the outside. Then we innovation coming in, and we use walk, we use kitchen tools to create our network, and that's replicate easily toward the community. They don't at first they don't believe that it's so easy to build this kind of thing. But when they see on television, because television grab these ideas, okay, they see this device is so simple, many people doesn't believe on it. But then when the television coming in and then they see this it's possible, then people grab these things. Okay, but then we need to write the whole thing in local language, the Indonesian language. Most of the problem, our major problem is the language. Most of the knowledge, language of the knowledge is in English. So we need to translate it to Indonesians. I have to say thank you to IDRC as well. Because, okay, this is still new from the printing, only last week finished. I don't think you guys know about this. you may be seen the English version. This one is the Indonesian language version. So we have to translate this to Indonesia. And then after I'm coming back to Indonesia after this, and then we will distribute about 3,000 books of this to schools and universities. That way, a lot more students can learn how to build the network themselves. So I have to give this to IDRC. Thank you very much for the support. You are on film. Don't worry, we have the English version for that. But that helps a lot. A lot of people downloading the file from the web because the 3,000 book is not enough, so they're downloading this file from the web. Okay, so wireless is one thing. The other thing, after the wireless network is the knowledge on wireless network is what's that? Receive or they get the knowledge on wireless network, then they create the neighborhood network. Okay, in Indonesian it's not neighborhood network. We call it RTRWNet. If you look at Google Trend, you can see this trend since 2006, actually. The Wak Bolik, we call it Wajan Bolik in Indonesian language. In English, it's Wak Bolik. You can see the trend is going up from 2006. It's detected by Google. So this neighborhood network, wireless network, voice over IP, and the last one is the healthy internet. Surprisingly, a lot of Indonesian actually wants censorship for the internet, not done by the government, but by themselves. So they want to learn how to censor the internet by themselves, especially schools, household. They really want to protect their young ones from the pornographic sites from the internet. So the healthy internet issue is becoming huge issue. One of my colleagues in the healthy internet activities, they actually creating a blog award. Those blogs who publish healthy internet will be given weekly award. Having this kind of award, we have 2 million blog on healthy internet in Indonesia today. That's only one year process. Okay, so that kind of activity actually spreading the knowledge to the people at low cost. It's basically the power of word of mouth, because we cannot use the formal education system for this, so we use the informal system. But we need what you did in Penang, actually. You guys actually invite the main activist for the healthy internet, Doni, to Penang by IDRC. That's actually creating a huge impact to Indonesia, because the Indonesian think, I think we are in the right path. So you guys actually creating a lot of damage in Indonesia, because by inviting these bad guys to Penang, to other conferences. Okay, so that's on healthy internet. The other topic we are actually, my wife is working on, is ICT for women. She actually giving free ICT lessons for women, but we are actually facing different problem because of that. Most of the women doesn't know computer. Takes only 3 days to know how to operate the computers in Linux Ubuntu, operate the office, operate internet. 3 days is fine with them. The problem is not that. The problem is we have to pay the women to come to the workshop because they lose their income by coming to our workshop. So we have to find a donor agency to pay this women to come. So that's our problem there. But we actually funded by HIFOS from the Netherlands for giving this kind of workshop. So it works. But then we think this kind of thing doesn't sustain. So we have to think differently to make this process sustain. By paying the women to come, it's impossible for us to sustain. So that's one of our problem for the women, ICT in women. Okay. My latest toys, actually, internet is IT, and internet is now part of the curriculum at Indonesian schools, secondary schools, and high schools. So it's part of the curriculum. The problem is only 4,000 schools has internet access. We have 240,000 schools in Indonesia. Only 4,000 has internet access. So most of them has no internet access. So 2 months ago today, I remaster Ubuntu Linux operating system. So I include Moodle, Wiki, webmail, chatting server, and everything into Ubuntu. It's not funded by everyone, but then I put it on the web. And within 2 months, we have 25,000 URL on that Ubuntu. I call it school on and offline, so it can be used for school online and school offline. So we actually learn, we can teach students without having internet access. Okay, the idea is to transform the student from just to write something on the blog. It's very easy to write blog. It's very easy to write wiki. So it's on the computer. It's live DVD. So it can be used on server, live DVD. So the other client computer can access to the live DVD server and can play with it. You can install it as well because it's Ubuntu. The ISO file is being copied. It's done by Chris. So if everyone wants to copy the file, it's welcome. The problem is I install the Indonesian version of WordPress, Wiki. I can create the English version if you like. It's very easy. It's only 2 hours. It takes only 2 hours to remaster the Ubuntu operating system to make a live DVD. Okay. Having this on the web, then people download these things for free. Okay, and then they invite me to give workshop. Okay, they give money when they invite me to give workshop. So I make money a little bit, but so it's a sustainable process. People fund this thing by themselves because they need they see the it solve their problems, and they're willing to pay for that. Okay, so what we need from IDRC to replicate this is just like similar to the 2.4 gigahertz problem, maybe just grab this thing to international level and then spread this words to other nations, and that will create a lot of damage within the country because they think, oh, okay, I think we are in the right path, so we need to go that way. We don't IDRC don't have to pay all the activity within the country, but by grabbing only like giving incentive to some of the main guys, that's really creating a lot of activity within the country. And why I use camera for this, because I learned that video is more appealing to most people when they see these things. Okay, by reading, it's Indonesian. Indonesian is definitely like to read. They more on seeing film and listening. So I it's forced me to make film of this because that's will make the people in Indonesia believe that they are in the right path. So what I like to suggest to IDRC is basically the incentive, okay? Not really for Indonesian sites. It's not really the quality of the book or the knowledge, because what we need actually more practical knowledge, like the walk balik, this kind of thing. It's very practical. That's what we really need. Not really scholarly research. To be honest, the majority needs something simple. They need solutions. If they see the benefit, they will grab the solution for them. They will invest their own money. They will build their infrastructure if that's really the solution for them. So very simple, but not much funding, but you will create a lot of damage in the country. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ono. Well, not sure what to say. I think, like yesterday, we have several different perspectives, all to me of great value. But I and I don't think we should try to, you know, sort of all agree or bring things together. But my sense, perhaps sharing this, is that I would be happy if other perspectives came out, because I think other people in the room have you know. And maybe I'd put it this way, if you were, seeing as we have IDRC here, if you were suggesting to IDRC what kind of research they should support in the next 5 to 10 years, what would you particularly focus on? You don't have to address that question. You can say anything you want, of course, but I would be interested in that. Sorry. Alice.
I think there are a lot of ideas there that we could use for future research. I just want to start firstly with Laurent and the notion of openness as a principle to drive research and also to ensure access, improve access, and create equitable knowledge societies. And I would suggest that openness is a way of putting it would be that it's a necessary condition, but it's not a sufficient condition to ensure equity. That I think it creates opportunities for access, but I'm not sure that it on its own will achieve that. So that takes me to your notion of incentives rather than interventions, because I think there's a link there. And again, I would say I don't think these should be juxtaposed. That I think you're right that the lessons of the last 5 years are that we can do a lot of things more effectively at lower cost by incentivizing them, particularly for the private sector to pick up some of public, you know, risk and expenditure, et cetera, in those ways. And I think the very obvious example of this that has been used very widely by multilateral agencies is around universal access and service, that the very heavy-handed universal service fund kind of interventions, the telecenter, technology-driven models, never really were quite unsuccessful, whereas incentivizing access to markets through underserviced, through competitive bids, reverse bids, like in Chile and those kinds of things, you can incentivize access to so-called, you know, uneconomic areas. And just broadly, the notion that we have this, you know, information gap with everybody who doesn't have access to communications, whereas in fact what we had was an efficiency gap because markets weren't able to operate effectively and allocate resources effectively. So I think certainly that is one of the lessons of the last 5 years. I would just caution again that it's a total solution, because I think there are certain things, and I'm thinking particularly in the context which I've personally been struggling with in South Africa, of what public broadcasting means in a converged digital environment, and what, you know, the public interest aspects of it. Can you simply meet these by creating, you know, public service funds that everybody can buy, and it's incentivized, and, you know, the people who are doing the work actually get the money and that sort of thing? And I think there's certain public interest things that there isn't a commercial value. You know, there's not enough commercial value in them for them to be done. So I don't think how almost, you know, no matter how much money you throw at Chivenda News broadcasting, it's not going to be worthwhile anybody paying for it with an audience of, you know, probably a million maximum if everybody who spoke Chivenda was watching. So I think there are always going to be state interventions for the marginalized, but I think the cost of them and the scope of them can be reduced by incentivizing and creating efficiencies and things in those other areas. So I think that is an area certainly of further exploration and research. I wanted to just pick up on a few things that Michael said about the supporting of research, but not the reading, or the publication, not the reading, and stuff. And sort of contextualizing it into an area that we didn't really get to, or I didn't get to discuss yesterday because my input was much longer than 2 pages and longer than 10 minutes. But it's something that we've been working very extensively in a long period of time with LearnNet, so with LearnAsia and RIA, and originally, of course, with Bill and Dursey. And that is really about the not only the multidisciplinary interface interface between different disciplines, which is absolutely critical to the work that we do in the region, but also getting that research and sometimes, you know, less depressing and fabulous conferences and research that's out there to actually feed into policy processes and to have sort of practical application. And so I think an area for us that we see as very critical that we will pursue wherever the funding comes from, we believe it's so important, is this development of indigenous local policy intellectuals that can really engage with the local case, with the local conditions and with, you know, local politicians and regulators and that kind of thing. And I think again, you know, Africa's probably the worst example of it. I think there's that kind of engagement and activity going on, and not least of all because of the third year now of CPR South and the attempt to build indigenous and organic knowledge and intellectuals there. But in Africa, I mean, if you do a Google search of Africans writing on ICT policy and regulation, you cannot get 5 people who are on the continent still writing on that area. So, and I think that engagement of people who are really familiar with the local politics is really important. And the other side of it is that African academics, the sort of academic ethos, the culture, is highly uncritical. So you can't actually present your findings, your evidence on policy in a way that's going to criticize the people who've, you know, messed it up, got it wrong. So I think that part of the work is something that's very important in terms of not just getting the research and the multidisciplinary focus, but actually disseminating it. Not only disseminating it, you know, for other NGOs to do something else with it, which is obviously important, but really trying to find ways of feeding it into policy formulation and regulation, intervening in public participation processes where they exist. They're limited certainly on our continent, but they do exist. Having public interest inputs into those, because generally those are the only inputs that people get there are from the mobile operators or whatever, and those kind of interests become self-fulfilling. So that interface, that intersection between academic work, research, conferences, publications, and the applied knowledge on the field to create change, I think is something that's been a big concern for us within LearnNet.
Thank you. I'd like to endorse what Laurent said regarding incentives. I think we really need to look at incentives, because even in your interventions, even in creating these project-based telecenters or whatever, you are creating incentives. So I think it's very important to understand the incentives. So then once you understand the incentives, it's then a sort of a second stage, which is how do we create better incentives? You can't just jump to creating the incentives. And in the policy game, as Alison mentioned yesterday, we can see the good solutions. And then we also see that governments that have been given the advice, this has worked in such and such country, here's the solution, they don't adopt it. Now there is an answer to that, which is that they are working under a different incentive system. So we have to understand that, and then how do we change that incentive? Waiting for the right leader to appear. I'm not a fan of that particular approach, right? But I am a fan of the crisis approach. You know, Rahm Emanuel, don't ever let a crisis go to waste, right? India wouldn't be a developing country today if they didn't hit the wall in 1991, right? So there's something very good about hitting the wall. That is another. But then, you know, given that isn't available, that's something you don't control, then what are the sort of incremental solutions? And that is the policy intervention process. Now here, Mike's timetable question, right? The time frames of projects doesn't really allow you to do a really systematic job. I think that should be a research project in itself. How does one change the incentive set within government? How does one achieve fundamental changes in policy approaches? At LearnAsia, I think we've been, perhaps praised by some people for achieving significant policy change. I'm not very impressed by what we've done. I can roll back a tax. I can call my friends. I can twist some arms. I mean, I've got the relationships in Sri Lanka. I can do all kinds of stuff. But none of it is really long-term. The really impressive thing to do would be to get policy enlightenment, Carol Weiss's term, right? How do we get long-term changes in mindset? Now, that is not never within the 18-month, 24-month project time frame. And people are not incentivized. Again, people who are researchers like us are really oriented towards getting the quick wins, the low-hanging fruit, but not policy enlightenment. But why, I'm not saying that, you know, I don't think people should be given money for unlimited times and, you know, I don't think that's realistic. But on the other hand, I think we should turn the research agenda onto the process itself. How does the policy process work? And coming back and finally to the openness question, Laurent, which is the whole issue. Again, I mean, the project time frame where we need to control the process, we need to control the outputs, we need to give quality, doesn't allow us to do, I mean, basically it keeps us in an elite frame. If I were to go down into the villages, if I were to bring more people in, and we've done it with one project that was not funded by IDRC, we've done it with one project where we went with Sarro there down to the villages and brought the input of people on water management and dam safety up. And we got a big win. CEDA spent maybe 9,000 Canadian in Sri Lanka. CEDA gave us about 9,000 from local money, and we put in maybe triple or quadruple that in various kinds of local donations, partner funds. And the end result is a $71 million project that was approved for repairing the major dams in Sri Lanka. But that's pretty iffy, right? That was done in 2005, and the project, the dam, the result was in 2008, right? That's a four-year time frame. And that's tough work to do, and it's very uncertain, and it doesn't really sort of match up with the evaluation and monitoring things that Mike is talking about. I think that is definitely, again, an area where we need to develop better instruments to capture these and to create the incentives for the researchers as well to do policy-relevant work that sort of ends up in policy enlightenment rather than only in policy change. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I found the discussion fascinating. I apologize for having to dart in and out. We take our board very seriously at IDRC, and a couple of our board members were asking penetrating questions on our programming. So please forgive me for not being here throughout. I've sensed throughout this conference that in focusing very much on ICTs, we've been missing out part of the picture which really matters to people on the ground in some countries, that's also technological in a sense, and that is the spread of satellite TV and its impact on societies in parts of the world. While I was in India, I noticed that satellite TV wasn't reaching into every last home in remote parts of India, but it was reaching into villages, and that people were probably better informed about the world at large, which to them meant other parts of India, than they might have been years before. And I think it's important for those working on ICTs to chart what's happening in the media, with the media, because there may be some things the media is better at than some of the channels were looking at. The best of the foreign correspondents when I was in India, I think a friend of Amartya is also Anand Girdaras, who's now studying at this university, gave a lecture at IDRC not long ago, and when he was asked what are the principal drivers of change or in India, he said mobiles and satellite TV. So I think that's been a bit absent from our discussion, at least when I was in the room. The media's come up tangentially several times, but I think they don't actually live in separate universes, and it would be helpful to think about them. By the way, satellite TV, a country I lived in and adored for a number of years, was Egypt. And I keep going back to Egypt to see how it's changing. And contrary to some perceptions, in some ways it's changed for the better. But when I lived there 35 years ago, the media was totally unfree. There were one or two opposition rags that were largely publishing fantasies, and people had no real access to news beyond the BBC radio news, which everybody who could understand English listened to in English, and the others listened to their Arabic service. Today, nobody in Egypt looks at state television. Everybody looks at Jazeera, Arabia, BBC, what have you. Interestingly, the country is no freer than it was politically. If anything, it's less free. And that inspires caution about extrapolating from developments that we think should bring about greater social, economic, political freedom and choice to the reality on the ground. It may be that all this excellent information to people is a sort of narcotic. They enjoy it on its own terms, but don't translate it into any form of activism on the ground, because activism on the ground in Egypt doesn't pay, by and large. So those angles, I think, need to be built in, because I think there's often a sense that simply because there's a great deal going on the net, or quite a little bit going on cell phone networks and SMS eruptions, so to speak, that this actually leads to change. I wonder if in every case that's true. So I just thought I'd add that.
I have lots of thoughts, and I'm not sure that it'll turn out the way I want it to, but I think that I have deep stakes in the way in which this session is going to be framed, because I come from India, where one-third of the world's poor live. And in that sense, I think what we deem fit in terms of filling the knowledge gaps, in terms of inclusion, in terms of equity, are extremely significant because IDRC is one of the very few funders left in the ICTD space. So, I mean, with that self-disclosure, I think I'd really like to turn to some of the points that Laura made and some others have made. I think one thing is very clear, that the initial interventions in terms of telecenters and everything failed. Now, the question is to really learn from the failures. And if you learn from the failures, I think one response is to say we must incentivize markets. The other thing is to say, how can we do those interventions differently? In the sense that, in some ways, I felt when the telecenters descended on India and the rest of the developing world, they were an idea whose time had not yet come, in some senses. And just like you mentioned, Clotilde, that we all seem to understand now what infrastructure is, you know, what those machines are, what their functionalities are. Now we have mobiles, but we still don't know what content is. And so to kind of figure out what institutional preparedness, what capabilities are needed in order for us to create a dynamic between people and knowledge, we need to kind of create interventions that will allow a richer kind of telecenter experience, which is beyond just accessing email, which is beyond just, you know, communicating, which is beyond just, you know, going and surfing the internet as consumers. So I think that calls for an entirely different design around intervention, which is not going to be necessarily possible for markets to do because they have their limits. And to that extent, I was quite intrigued by the facts that you brought to the table, which was that you found in some research, which I'm not familiar with, that the Gini coefficient actually seems to be higher where there is more investment in mobile telephony. I think that's one thing that people have been talking about. Scholars like Padmini Swaminathan and others in India have been, feminist economists have been talking about in India, is that with the spectacular growth rate, why aren't we talking really about the inequalities in the Indian context? It's staggering. The people who are disenfranchised, who are falling off the brink, and who development interventions are not able to target. And within this, it's not a coincidence that we are increasingly moving towards incentives. The fact that we're moving towards incentivizing markets and incentivizing development as a marketized form of inclusion, it's not a coincidence. There are innumerable studies in the field of education, for instance, about the voucher system. You know, the kind of household level inequity in health access because of privatization of healthcare is very clear, you know, the fact that women are missing out on healthcare. So I think when we talk really about equity and when we talk about inclusion, we should really be very clear about the limits of the market. And we also have to be more, we have to abandon the poverty of imagination we have in planning intervention. You know, we need to redesign them in some sense, to accommodate for the learnings from the failures that we have had, rather than say those things failed, so, you know, let's jettison them and let's say that there's no use for telecenters or there's no use for these public spaces. The other thing is about equity and openness that, you know, you made, and I also think that the tremendous opportunity for development is really in this interface between, openness and the ethos and value of equity. And while I think equity presupposes openness, it's not going to obtain only with openness. And I think that's very clear. And a very interesting parallel here is the amount of literature that exists in the past 20 years about participatory development. That participatory development is extremely important for women's empowerment, but is not the sufficient condition for women's empowerment. If you want women's voices to be heard in the development agenda setting, then you might want to start with participation, but you can't be sure that women are participating just because there are these open processes on the ground. The other thing in the way in which, Alison, you formulated your intervention, I was just thinking, might it be worthwhile to think about inclusion not as if it's an adjustment on the edges in terms of you know, looking really at, is the meaning of development, you know, to reduce state expenditure? Is that the purpose of development, or is it something else? I mean, when we look at this relationship between civil society, state, and the market, I think we really have to have a broader canopy of what society is all about, what development is all about. And is development, is the purpose of development to minimize state expenditure? You know, that seems to me a bit of a limited way to really look at, you know, to really look at equity, inclusion, and the way in which, you know, we can look at citizen rights or the rights of the disenfranchised. So for me, you know, if it's possible for the markets to address certain things, certainly, you know, the states should create the conditions for that to happen. But that, for me, is not the complete picture. I think the complete picture is to begin elsewhere, to ask what is the purpose of development. And then to say, well, the state must spend on these things, rather than to say, you know, let's look at how states can spend lesser. I think the last point I want to make is really about research. And in this, I think that in this room, and this has been said very elegantly many times before, that if you look at the information society opportunity for development, it's in two things. One is that we have this transforming public sphere, which in many ways is making it possible for innumerable people who didn't have a voice and who didn't have visibility to really come into the public sphere. So today you have counterpublics, you have subaltern counterpublics, people creating their own blogs, and the fantastic example that you gave yesterday of the creation of music and all that, which needn't necessarily be on the, you know, the chart busters, but they are there, you know, and people are actually accessing those. The second transformatory aspect for development is in the ways in which the kind of programming of institutional building blocks can really be turned on their head. So today you can actually build institutions for the poor, for better governance, but for accountable governance in different ways. I mean, and this is like a moment in time historically that you can do it. And if you miss the bus, then you've missed it. And I think that without good governance, you're not going to be good governance in the sense of accountable governance that allows people to set agendas, you're not going to be able to address poverty and inclusion. But I think instead of having scholars look at public sphere theories and look at, you know, media theories, you know, sitting out there, you know, saying their own thing, and have the developmental people studying poverty and institutions sit differently, I think we need to really find intersections between these spaces. You know, how are you going to really create the ways in which, you know, these two different spheres of thinking, you know, in terms of, you know, political economic thought and social cultural thought really, really come together? And here I feel that we have something to learn from the ways in which people who've been writing critiques of development have really talked about the discourse of the consumer user versus the discourse of the citizen. And I think that's really important when we talk about openness, technology, and inclusion. And if you may permit me just 20 more seconds, I'll finish this. I think we are in the danger of really this rhetorical technology user discourse with the individuation and atomization of the development process, as if each of us will go back home and seek our own developmental aspirations through this one computer or through a gizmo on our own. Somewhere I think we're discounting the role of social movements, collectives, women's groups, you know, citizens' groups and communities. And if we want to privilege social movements, then I think we really have to look at social theory and what it has to say about the nature of the information society we have. And I have been deeply influenced recently by the work of Christian Fuchs and his own formulation of prosumer. I'm not sure how many people have read Fuchs. The producer-consumer. The fact that in this world of the internet, each of us is somehow in the illusion that we are producing, but we are within this market canopy where we are prosumers, where, you know, our knowledge is being appropriated in some sense by a capitalist capitalist network which allows you free access, but then, you know, appropriates what you're doing. That's the logic of Wikipedia, that's the logic of Google, that's the logic of the way in which the information society is built. And I don't want to be dystopic I mean, I don't want to sound dystopic, like, you know, the world is coming to an end, you know, what will we do? I mean, that's not my intent at all. But what I'm saying is there's a lot of literature on the meanings of what development need to do for social movements. And I don't agree that we have knowledge gaps in that area. I think there's lots being done, especially in the National Rural Employment Guarantee Program in the state of Andhra Pradesh in India, which is a massive program with an annual budget of $8 billion, which is 391 billion Indian rupees, where the success of the program has come out only because of the transparency of the ICT-based system that the government decided to put in place. It's a large social protection scheme, you know, and people are able to, you know, access their right to livelihoods, their right to life, their right to information on account of the robust institutional frameworks that have been created by the government through computer systems. And that combined with the social audit processes where people are coming and challenging the data systems, you know, that is the dialectic that we need to be talking about in the knowledge gaps. Thanks.
I think it's probably time, and we can carry on this discussion, I think, and it flows a little bit logically into the next session. So if you agree, we'll take a break. I'm not going to try to influence what the next session has to say, but I think some continuing in bringing things together some of the central research questions would not be out of place. Thanks.